You mean a place?
In this city, a place.
I've never thought about it.
She stood up. Well, think about it and let's go there. The Heath was the first place that came to mind, but Amy's London, like those little maps you pick up at the airport, was a city centered around St. James's, bordered to the north by Regent's Park, stretching as far as Kensington to the west, with occasional forays into the wilds of Ladbroke Grove, and only as far east as the Barbican. She knew no more of what might lie at the southern end of Hungerford Bridge than at the end of a rainbow.
It's a big sort of park, I explained, near where I grew up.
Okay, well, let's go there. We cycled through town, winding round buses and racing the occasional courier, three of us in a line, her security detail first. His name was Granger, then Amy, then me. The idea of Amy cycling through London infuriated Judy, but Amy loved to do it. She called it her freedom in the city, and maybe at one traffic light in 20, the adjacent driver would lean forward on the wheel, put down his window, having noticed something familiar about the blue-grey, feline eyes, that dainty triangular chin. But by that point, the lights would change and we'd be gone. When she rode, she was in urban camouflage anyway. Black sports bra, black vest, and a grungy pair of black cycling shorts worn at the crotch, and only Granger seemed likely to catch anybody's attention. A 6'4", 250-pound black man wobbling on a titanium-framed racer, stopping every now and then to take an A to Z out of his pocket and furiously study it. He was from Harlem, originally, where we got a grid. And the inability of Londoners to likewise number their streets was something he couldn't forgive. He'd written off the whole city on account of it. For him, London was a sprawl of bad food and bad weather in which his one task, to keep Amy safe, was made more difficult than it needed to be. At Swiss Cottage, he waved us on to a traffic island and peeled his bomber jacket off to reveal a pair of massive biceps.
"I'm telling you right now, I got no idea where this place is at," he said, slapping his handlebar with his map. "You get halfway down some tiny little street, Christchurch Close, Hingleberry fucking corner, and then this thing's telling me, turn to page 53. Motherfucker, I'm on a bike!"
"Chin up, Granger," said Amy in a terrible British accent, and pulled his big head down onto her shoulder for a moment, squeezing it fondly. Granger freed himself and glared at the sun. "Since when is it this hot?"
"Well, it's summer. England can sometimes get hot in summer. Should have worn shorts."
"I don't wear shorts."
"I don't think this is a very productive conversation. We're on a traffic island."
"I'm done. We're heading back," said Granger.
He sounded very final about it, and I was surprised to hear anyone speak to Amy this way.
"We are not going back."
"Then you best take this,"
said Granger, dropping the A to Z in the basket at the front of Amy's bike.
"'Cause I can't use it."
"I know the way from here," I offered, mortified to be the cause of the problem. "It's really not far."
"We need a vehicle,"
Granger insisted without looking at me. We almost never looked at each other. Sometimes I thought of us as two sleeper agents, mistakenly assigned to the same mark and wary of eye contact in case the one blew the other's cover.
"I hear there's some cute boys up in there," said Amy in a sing-song voice.
This was meant to be an imitation of Granger.
"They're hiding in the trees."
She put her foot to the pedal, pushed off, swerving into the traffic.
"I don't mix play with work,"
said Granger sniffily, getting back astride his dainty bike with dignity.
"I am a professional person."
We set off back up the hill, monstrously steep, huffing and puffing and following Amy's laughter. I can always find the Heath. All my life I'd taken paths that lead me back, whether I wanted it or not, to the Heath. But I'd never consciously sought and found Kenwood. I only ever stumble upon it. It was the same this time. I was leading Granger and Amy up the lanes, past the ponds, over a hill, trying to think where might be the prettiest, quietest, and yet most interesting place to stop with a too easily bored superstar, when I saw the little cast iron gate, and behind the trees, the white chimneys. "No cycles," said Amy, reading a sign, and Granger, seeing what was coming, began to protest, but was overruled.
"We'll be like an hour," she said, getting off her bike and passing it to him. Maybe two.
I'll call you.
Have you got that thing?
Granger folded his arms across his massive chest.
Yeah, but I ain't giving it to you. Not without me being there. No way. Forget about it.
As I got off my bike, though, I saw Amy put out her adamant little hand to receive a small something wrapped in cling film, closing her palm around it, which something turned out to be a joint for me. Long and American in design, with no tobacco in it at all. We settled under the magnolia, right in front of Kenwood House, and I leant against the trunk and smoked, while Amy lay flat in the grass with her black baseball cap low over her eyes, her face turned up towards me.
Feel better?
But aren't you gonna have any?
I don't smoke, obviously.
She was sweating like she did on stage, and now grabbed at her vest, lifting it up and down to create a tunnel of air so that I received a glimpse of that pale strip of midriff that once so mesmerized the world.
I've got a coldish Coke in my bag.
I don't drink that shit, and neither should you. She got up on her elbows to take me in more fully.
You don't look all that comfortable to me.
She sighed and rolled over onto her stomach to face the milling summer crowds, going down to the old stables for scones and tea, or through the doors of the great house for art and history.
I have a question,
I said, knowing I was stoned and that she wasn't, but finding it hard to keep in mind the second half of that proposition.
You do this with all your assistant?
She considered.
No. Not this exactly. People are different. I always do something. I can't have somebody in my face 24/7 who's going to act shy around me. No time. And I don't have the luxury of getting to know you in some slow, delicate way or being politely English about it, saying please and thank you whenever I want you to do something. If you work for me, you just have to jump to it.
I've been doing this a while, and I figured out that a few intense hours at the beginning save a lot of time and misunderstandings and bullshit later on.
You're getting off easy, believe me. I had a bath with Melanie.
I attempted a goofy extended joke, hoping to hear her laugh again, but instead she squinted at me.
Another thing you should understand is that it's not that I don't get your British irony. I just don't like it. I find it adolescent. 99% of the time when I meet British people, my feeling is, grow up!
Her mind turned back to Melanie in that bath. Wanted to know if her nipples were too long.
Paranoid.
Were they?
Were who what?
Her nipples. Long.
They're like fucking fingers.
I spat some of my coke onto the grass.
You're funny. I come from a long line of funny people. God knows why the British think they're the only people allowed to be funny in this world.
I'm not that British.
Oh, babe, you're as British as they come.
She reached into her pocket for her phone and began going through her texts. Long before it became a general condition, Amy lived in her phone. She was a pioneer in this, as in so many things.
Granger, 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 Granger doesn't know what to do with himself if he doesn't have anything to do with himself. He's like me. We've got the same mania. He reminds me of how tiring I can be to others.
Her thumb wavered over her brand new BlackBerry.
With you, I'm hoping for cool, calm, collected. Could do with some of that around here. Jesus Christ, he sent me like 15 texts already. He just needs to hold the bikes. Says he's near the... What in the hell is the men's pond?
I told her in detail. She made a skeptical face.
If I know Granger, there's no way he's swimming in fresh water. He won't even swim in Miami.
Big believer in chlorine.
No, he can just hold the bikes.
She poked a finger in my belly.
Are we done here?
Got another one of those if you need it.
This is a one-time deal. Take advantage.
One time, persistent. Rest of the time, you work when I work. Which is always.
I am so relaxed right now.
Good! But is there anything else to do around here besides this? Which is how we came to be wandering around inside Kenwood House, followed for a while by an eagle-eyed 6-year-old girl whose distracted mother refused to listen to her excellent hunch. I trailed red-eyed behind my new employer, noticing for the first time her very particular way of looking at paintings, how, for example, she ignored all men,
not as painters, but as subjects. Walking past a Rembrandt self-portrait without pausing, ignoring all the earls and dukes and dismissing with a single line, "Get a haircut!" A merchant seaman with my father's laughing eyes. Landscapes, too, were nothing to her. She loved dogs, animals, fruit, fabrics, and flowers especially. Over the years, I learnt to expect the bunch of anemones we had just seen in the Prado or the peonies from the National Gallery would reappear, a week or so later, in vases all over whichever house or hotel we happened to be in at the time. Many small, painted dogs, too, leapt from canvases into her life. Kenwood was the source of Colette, an incontinent Joshua Reynolds spaniel bought in Paris a few months later, whom I then had to walk twice a day for a year. But more than any of these, she loved the pictures of the women. Their faces, their fripperies, their hairstyles, their corsetry, their little pointy shoes. "Oh my God, it's Julie!" Amy was across the red damask room, in front of a life-size portrait, laughing. I came up behind and peered at the Van Dyke in question. No doubt about it. There was Judy Ryan, in all her horrible glory, but 400 years ago, wearing an unflattering black-and-white tent of lace and satin, and with her right hand, half-maternal, half-menacing, resting on the shoulder of a young, unnamed page. Her bloodhound eyes, terrible fringe, the long, chinless face, it was all there. We laughed so much it seemed to me that something changed between us. Some formality or fear fell away, so that when, a few minutes later, Amy claimed to be charmed by something called the Infant Academy, I felt free enough, at least, to disagree. It's a bit sentimental, isn't it? And weird. I like it. I like the weirdness. Naked babies painting naked pictures of each other. I'm a sucker for babies right now. She looked wistfully at a boy child with a coy smirk on his cherubic face. He reminds me of my baby. You really don't like it? I didn't know at the time that Amy was pregnant with Cara, her second child. She probably didn't know it herself. To me it was obvious the whole picture was ridiculous, and the pink-cheeked infants especially repulsive. But when I looked at her face, I saw she was serious. And what are babies, I can remember thinking, if they can do this to women? Do they have the power to reprogram their mothers? To make their mothers into the kinds of women their younger selves would not even recognize? The idea frightened me. I restricted myself to praising her son Jay's beauty in comparison to these cherubim, not very convincingly or coherently, thanks to the weed, and Amy turned to me, frowning. You don't want kids? That it? Or you think you don't want them? Oh, I know. I don't want them. She patted me on the top of my head, as if there were not 12 years between us, but 40. You're what, 23? Things change. I was exactly the same. No, I've always known, since I was little. I'm not the mothering type. Never wanted them, never will. Saw what it did to my mother. What did it do to her? To be asked so directly forced me to actually consider the answer. She was a young mum, then a single mum. There were things she wanted to be, but she couldn't, not then. She was trapped. She had to fight for any time for herself. Amy put her hand on her hips and assumed a pedantic look. Well, I'm a single mom, and I can assure you my baby doesn't stop me doing a damn thing. He's like my fucking inspiration right now, if you really want to know. It's a balance, for sure, but you've just got to want it enough. I thought of the Jamaican nanny, Estelle, who let me into Amy's house each morning and then disappeared to the nursery. That there might be any practical divergence between my mother's situation and her own did not seem to occur to Amy, and this was one of my earliest lessons in her way of viewing the differences between people, which were never structural or economic, but always essentially differences of personality. I looked at the colour in her cheeks and where my hands were, out in front of me, like a politician making a point, and realised that our discussion had become rapidly and strangely heated, without either of us really wanting it to, as if the very word baby was a kind of accelerant. I put my hands back by my sides and smiled.
It's just not for me.
We headed back through the galleries, looking for the exit, falling in step with a tour guide. He was telling a tale I'd known since childhood, about a brown girl, the daughter of a Caribbean slave and her British master, brought to England and raised in this big white house by well-to-do relatives, one of whom happened to be the Lord Chief Justice. A favourite anecdote of my mother's. Except my mother did not tell it like the tour guide. She did not believe that a great uncle's compassion for his brown great-niece had the power to end slavery in England. I picked up one of the leaflets stacked on a side table and read that the girl's father and mother had met in the Caribbean, as if they'd been strolling through a beach resort at cocktail hour. Amused, I turned to show it to Amy, but she was in the next room, listening intently to the guide, hovering at the edges of the tour group as if she were part of it. She was always moved by stories that proved the power of love, and what difference did it make to me if she was? But I couldn't help myself. I began channeling my mother, commenting ironically on the commentary, until the guide became irritated and directed his group outside. When we too headed for the exit, I took over Amy's tour, leading her through a low tunnel of ivy bent into an arbour, and describing the Zong as if that great ship were floating right there in the lake right before us. It was an easy image to conjure up. I knew it intimately. It had sailed so many times through my childhood nightmares. On its way to Jamaica, but far off course due to an error in navigation, low on drinking water, filled with thirsty slaves. "Oh?" said Amy, pulling a briar rose from its bush, and captained by a man who, fearing the slaves would not survive the rest of the journey, but not wanting a financial loss on his first voyage, gathered 133 men, women, and children, and threw them overboard, shackled to each other. Spoilt cargo on which insurance could later be collected. The famously compassionate great-uncle oversaw that case, too, I told Amy, as my mother had told me, and he ruled against the captain, but only on the principle that the captain had made a mistake. He, and not the insurers, must take the loss. Those thrashing bodies were still cargo. You could still jettison cargo to protect the rest of your cargo. You just wouldn't be reimbursed for it. Amy nodded, touched the rose she had plucked between her left ear and her baseball cap, and knelt suddenly to pat a passing pack of small dogs that were dragging behind them a single walker. "Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger," I heard her tell a dachshund, and then, straightening up and facing me again. "If my dad hadn't died young, no way I'd be here. It's the pain. Jews, gays, women, blacks, the bloody Irish. That's our secret fucking strength." I thought of my mother, who had no patience for sentimental readings of history, and cringed. We left the dogs and walked on. The sky was cloudless, the heath filled with flowers and foliage. The ponds were golden pools of light, but I couldn't rid myself of this feeling of discomfort and imbalance. And when I tried to trace its source, I found myself back before that unnamed page in the gallery, a little gold ring in his ear, who looked beseechingly up at Judy's doppelganger as we'd laughed at her. She did not look back at him. She never could. She'd been painted in such a way as to make that impossible. But hadn't I also avoided his eye? As I avoided Granger's eye, and he avoided mine. I could see this little moor now with absolute clarity. It was as if he was standing on the path before me. Amy insisted we end that peculiar afternoon by swimming in the ladies' pond. Granger waited once more at the gates, three bikes at his feet, angrily turning the pages of his pocket penguin Machiavelli. A haze of pollen hovered just above the water. It seemed to be caught in the thick, drowsy air, though the water was frigid. I went in, cringingly, in my knickers and T-shirt, inching myself down the ladder, while two broad-beamed Englishwomen in sturdy speedos and swim caps bobbed nearby, offering unsolicited encouragement to all who were in the process of joining them.
"Really rather nice once you're in. Just keep kicking your legs till you feel them. If Wolf swam here, so can you."
Women to the right and left of me, some three times my age, slipped right off the deck into the water, but I couldn't get any deeper than my waist, and stalling for time, turned round and pretended instead to be admiring the scene. White-haired ladies moving in a stately circle through the foul-smelling duckweed. A pretty dragonfly dressed in Amy's favourite shade of green flitted by. I watched it land on the deck, just by my hand, and close its iridescent wings. Where was Amy? I had a moment of paralysing, weed-infected paranoia. Had she got in before me while I was fretting about my underwear? Already drowned? Tomorrow would I find myself at an inquest explaining to the world why I let a heavily insured, universally beloved Australian swim unaccompanied in an ice-cold North London pond. A banshee wail pierced the civilized scene. I turned back and saw Amy, naked, running from the changing room towards me, launching herself in a dive over my head and over the ladder, arms out, back perfectly arched, as if lifted from below by an invisible principal dancer, before hitting the water clean and true. 6. I didn't know that Tracy's father had gone to prison. It was my mother who told me, a few months after the fact. I see he's gone in again. She didn't have to say more or tell me to spend less time with Tracy. It was happening naturally anyway. A cooling off. One of those things that can happen between girls. At first I was distraught, thinking it permanent. But in fact it was only a hiatus, one of many we would have. Lasting a couple of months, sometimes longer, but always ending, not coincidentally, with her father getting out again, or else returning from Jamaica, where he often had to flee when things got hot for him in the neighbourhood. It was as if, when he was in, or away, Tracy went into standby mode, pausing herself like a videotape. Although in class we no longer shared a desk, we had been separated after Lily's party, my mother went up to the school and requested it. I had a clear view of her each day, and when there was trouble at home, I sensed it at once. It revealed itself in everything she did or didn't do. She made life as difficult as possible for our teacher. Not with explicit bad behaviour like the rest of us, not by swearing or fighting, but by an absolute withdrawal of her presence. Her body was there. Nothing else. She wouldn't answer questions or ask them, didn't involve herself in any activities or copy anything down, or even open her exercise book. And I understood, at such times, that for Tracy, time had stopped. If Mr. Sherman started shouting, she sat impassive at her desk, her eyes angled to a point above his head, her nose upturned, and nothing he could say, no threat and no degree of volume, had any effect. As I'd predicted, she never did forget those garbage pale kids' cards. And being sent to the headmistress's office held no fear for her. She stood up in the coat she had anyway never taken off, and walked out of the room as if it made no difference where she went or what happened to her. When she was in this state of mind, I took the opportunity to do those things that, when I was with Tracy, I felt inhibited from doing. I spent more time with Lily Bingham, for example, taking pleasure in her good humour and gentle way of being. She still played with dolls, knew nothing of sex, loved drawing and making things out of cardboard and glue. In other words, she was still a child, as I sometimes wished I could be. In her games, nobody died, or was afraid, or took revenge, or feared being uncovered as a fraud, and there was absolutely no black and no white. For, as she solemnly explained to me one day as we played, she herself was colourblind, and saw only what was in the person's heart. She had a little cardboard theatre of the Russian Ballet, bought in Covent Garden, and for her, a perfect afternoon involved manoeuvring the cardboard prince around the stage, letting him meet a cardboard princess and fall in love with her, while a scratchy copy of Swan Lake, her father's, played in the background. She loved ballet, though she was a poor dancer herself, too bandy-legged to have any real hopes, and she knew all the French words for everything, and the tragic life stories of Diaghilev and Pavlova. Tap dancing didn't interest her. When I showed her my well-worn copy of Stormy Weather, she reacted in a way I hadn't anticipated. She was offended by it, hurt, even. Why was everybody black? It was unkind, she said. To have only black people in a film, it wasn't fair. Maybe in America you could do that, but not here, in England. where everybody was equal anyway, and there was no need to go on about it. And we wouldn't like it, she said, if someone said to us that only black people could come to Isabel's dance class. That wouldn't be nice or fair to us, would it? We'd be sad about that. Or that only black people could come into our school. We wouldn't like that, would we? I said nothing. I put Stormy Weather back in my rucksack and went home, walking beneath a Willesden sunset of petroleum colours and quick-shunting clouds, going over and over this curious lecture in my mind, wondering what she could have meant by the word we. 7. When things were frosty between Tracy and me, I found Saturdays hard, and relied on Mr. Booth for conversation and advice. I brought new information to him, which I got from the library, and he added to what I had, or explained things I didn't understand. Mr. Booth hadn't known, for example, that it was not really Fred Astaire, but Frederick Austerlitz. But he understood what Austerlitz meant. He explained it was a name that must have come not from America, but from Europe, probably German or Austrian, possibly Jewish. To me, Astaire was America. If he had been on the flag, I would not have been surprised. But now I learned that he'd spent a lot of time in London, in fact, and that he had become famous here, dancing with his sister. And if I'd been born 60 years earlier, I could have gone to the Shaftesbury Theatre and seen him myself. And what more, said Mr. Booth, his sister was a far better dancer than him. Everybody said so. She was the star and he was the also-ran. Can't sing, can't act, balding, can dance a little. Ha ha ha. Well, he showed them, didn't he? Listening to Mr. Booth, I wondered if it were possible for me, too, to become a person who revealed themselves later in life, much later, so that one day, a long time from now, it would be Tracy sitting in the front row of the Shaftesbury Theatre, watching me dance, our positions reversed completely, my own superiority finally recognised by the world. And in later years, said Mr. Booth, taking my library book out of my hands and reading from it, in later years his daily routine was little changed from the life he had always led. He woke up at 5 a.m. and breakfasted on a single boiled egg that kept his weight at a constant 134 pounds. Addicted to television serials such as The Guiding Light and As the World Turns, he would telephone his housekeeper if he could not watch the soap operas to find out what had happened. Mr. Booth closed the book, smiled, and said, "What an odd fish." When I complained to Mr. Booth of Astaire's one imperfection, that he couldn't, in my opinion, sing, I was wrong-footed by how strongly he disagreed. Usually we agreed about everything and were always laughing together, but now he picked out the notes to all of me in a minimal sort of way on the piano and said, "But singing isn't just about belting it out, is it? It's not just who has the most wobble or the highest note. No, it's about phrasing and being delicate and getting just the right feeling from a song, the soul of it, so that something real happens inside you when a man opens his mouth to sing. And don't you want to feel something real rather than just having your poor ear holes bashed in?" He stopped talking and played All of Me in full, and I sang along with him, consciously trying to deliver each phrase in the same manner that Astaire does in Silk Stockings, cutting some lines short, half-speaking others, though it didn't feel natural to me. Together, Mr. Booth and I considered what it would be like to love the east, west, north, and south of somebody, to gain complete control of them, even if they loved, in return, only a small percentage of us. Usually I performed with one hand on the piano, facing out, because that's how the girls did it in the movies, and that way I could keep an eye on the clock over the church door and know when the last child had filed in, and therefore when it was time to stop. But on this occasion the desire to try to sing in harmony with that delicate melody, to match Mr. Booth's way of playing it, not just to belt it out, but to create a real feeling, made me instinctively turn inwards, halfway through the verse. And when I did, I saw that Mr. Booth was crying, very softly, but certainly crying. I stopped singing. "And he's trying to make her dance," he said. "Fred wants Sid to dance, but she won't, will she? She's what you'd call an intellectual, from Russia.
and she don't want to dance. And she says to him, "The trouble with dancing is you go, 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 but you don't get anywhere." And Fred says, "You're telling me?" "Lovely, lovely. Now look, dear, it's time for class. You'd best get your shoes on."
As we tied our laces and prepared to get back in line, Tracy said to her mother within my hearing, "See? She loves all them weird old songs." It had the tone of an accusation. I knew that Tracy loved pop music, but I didn't think the melodies were as pretty, and now I tried to say so. Tracy shrugged, stopping me in my tracks. Her shrugs had a power over me. They could end any topic. She turned back to her mother and said, "Likes old buggers, too." Her mother's reaction shocked me. She looked over and smirked. At that moment, my father was outside in the churchyard, in his usual spot under the cherry trees. I could see him with his pouch of tobacco in one hand and the cigarette paper in the other. He didn't bother to disguise these things from me any longer. But there was not a world in which I could make a cruel comment to another child and have my father or mother smirk or side with me in any way. It struck me that Tracy and her mother were on the same side, and I thought there was something unnatural about this, and that they seemed to know it, for in certain contexts they hid it. I felt sure that if my father had been present, Tracy's mother would not have dared to smirk.
"Best keep away from strange old men," she said, pointing at me.
But when I protested that Mr. Booth was not strange to us, that he was our dear old piano player and we loved him, Tracy's mother seemed bored as I talked, crossed her arms over her huge chest, and looked straight ahead.
"Mum thinks he's a nonce," explained Tracy.
I walked out of that lesson gripping my father's hand, but I didn't tell him what had happened. I didn't think of asking either of my parents for help in any matter, not any more. If anything, I thought only of protecting them. I went elsewhere for guidance. Books had begun to enter my life. Not good books, not yet. Still those old showbiz biographies that I read in the absence of sacred texts, as if they were sacred texts, taking a form of comfort from them, though they were hackwork done for quick money, barely given a second thought by their authors, surely, but to me, important. I kept certain pages folded and read lines over and over, like a Victorian lady reading her psalms. "He isn't doing that right." That was a very important one. It was what Astaire claimed he was thinking whenever he watched himself on screen, and I noted that third-person pronoun. This is what I understood by it. That for Astaire, the person in the film was not especially connected with him. And I took this to heart, or rather it echoed a feeling I already had, mainly that it was important to treat oneself as a kind of stranger, to remain unattached and unprejudiced in your own case. I thought you needed to think like that to achieve anything in this world. Yes, I thought that it was a very elegant attitude. And I became fixated, too, upon Katharine Hepburn's famous Fred and Ginger theory. He gives her class, she gives him sex. Was this a general rule? Did all friendships, all relations involve this discreet and mysterious exchange of qualities, this exchange of power? Did it extend to peoples and nations, or was it a thing that happened only between individuals? What did my father give my mother and vice versa? What did Mr. Booth and I give each other? What did I give Tracy? What did Tracy give me? Part 3. Intermission. 1. "Governments are useless. They can't be trusted," Amy explained to me. "And charities have their own agendas. Churches care more for souls than for bodies. And so if we want to see real change in this world," she continued, adjusting the incline on her running machine until I, who walked on a neighbouring one, seemed to be watching her dash up the side of Kilimanjaro, "well, then we ourselves have to be the ones to do it. Yes, we have to be the change we want to see." By we, she meant people like herself, of financial means and global reach, who happen to love freedom and equality, want justice, feel an obligation to do something good with their own fortune. It was a moral category, but also an economic one. And if you followed its logic all the way to the end of the revolving belt, then after a few miles you arrived at a new idea, that wealth and morality are in essence the same thing, for the more money a person had, then the more goodness, or potential for goodness, a person possessed. I mopped up my sweat with my vest and glanced at the screens in front of us. 7 miles for Amy, 1.5 for me. At last she was finished. We stepped off our machines, I passed her a towel, we walked together to the editing room. She wanted to review an early cut of a promo we were making for prospective donors, which didn't yet have its music or sound. We stood behind the director and editor and looked on as a version of Amy, a silent version, broke soil on the school project, large spade in hand, and laid the foundation stone with the help of a village elder. We watched her dance with her 6-year-old daughter, Cara, and a group of beautiful schoolgirls in their green and grey uniforms to music we could not hear, each stamp of her feet raising great clouds of red dust. I recalled seeing all these things happening months earlier, in reality, in the very moment that they happened, and thought how different they appeared now, in this format, as the editor moved things about with the ease his software allowed, intersplicing Amy in America with Amy in Europe and Amy in Africa, placing familiar events in a new order. "And this is how you get things done," she announced, after 15 minutes, satisfied, standing up, ruffling the young director's hair and heading for the showers. I stayed and helped finish the edit. A time-lapse camera had been placed on the building site back in February, and so now we could watch the whole school go up in a few minutes, as ant-like labourers moving too fast to be distinguished from each other, swarmed over it, a surreal demonstration of what was possible when good people of means decided to get things done. The kind of people able to build a girls' school in a rural West African village in a matter of months, simply because that is what they had decided to do. It pleased my mother to call Amy's way of doing things naive. But Amy felt she had already tried my mother's route, the political route. She'd gone to bat for presidential candidates back in the 80s and 90s, hosting dinners, making campaign contributions, haranguing audiences from the stages of stadiums. By the time I came into the picture, she was finished with all that, just as the generation she'd once encouraged to the ballot box, my generation, were finished. Now she was committed to making change happen on the ground. She wanted only to work with communities at a community level, and I honestly respected her commitment, and only occasionally, when some of her fellow good people of means came up to the Hudson Valley House to lunch or to swim and to discuss this or that venture, would it become very hard to avoid seeing the things my mother saw. At those times I really felt my mother at my shoulder, an invisible conscience or an ironic commentary pouring poison in my ear from thousands of miles away, as I tried to listen to all these various good people of means, famous for playing the guitar or singing or designing clothes or pretending to be other people, chatter over cocktails about their plans to end malaria in Senegal or bring clean wells to Sudan and so on. But I knew Amy herself had no abstract interest in power. She was motivated by something else. Impatience. To Amy, poverty was one of the world's sloppy errors, one among many, which might be easily corrected if only people would bring to the problem the focus she brought to everything. She hated meetings and long discussions, disliked considering an issue from too many angles. Nothing bored her more than, on the one hand this, and on the other hand that. She put her faith instead in the power of her own decisions, and these she made with her heart. Often these decisions were sudden, and were never changed or rescinded once she'd made them, for she believed in her own good timing, in timing itself, as a mystical force, a form of fate, operating at the global and cosmic level as much as at the personal. In fact, in Amy's mind, these three levels were connected. It was the good timing of fate, as she saw it, that burnt down the British headquarters of YTV on the 20th of June 1998, 6 days after she visited us. The wiring going wrong somehow in the middle of the night, sending a fire ripping through the place, destroying those miles and miles of VHS which had been, up until then, preserved from the corrupting influence of the London Underground. We were told it would be 9 months before the offices were habitable again. In the meantime, everybody was moved to an ugly, featureless office block in King's Cross. My commute was 20 minutes longer. I missed the canal, the market, Snowdon's birds. But I spent only 6 days in King's Cross. It was all over for me the moment Zoe brought a fax to my desk, addressed to me, with a phone number on it, which I was to ring, with no explanation. From the other end came the voice of Amy's manager, Judy Ryan. She told me Amy herself had requested that the brown girl in green come to her offices in Chelsea and be interviewed for a possible position. I was stunned. I paced outside that building for half an hour before I entered it, shaking, all the way up in the lift and through the hall. But when I walked into that room, I saw the decision already made, right there on her face. There was no anxiety for Amy, and no doubt. None of this, in her view, was coincidence or luck, or even happy accident. It was fate. The Great Fire, as the employees christened it, was only part of a conscious effort on behalf of the universe to bring the two of us together, Amy and me. A universe which at the same moment declined to intervene in so many other matters. 2. Amy had an unusual attitude to time, but her approach was very pure and I came to admire it. She wasn't like the rest of her tribe. She didn't need surgeons, didn't live in the past, fudge dates or use any of the usual forms of distraction or distortion. With her, it really was a matter of will. Over 10 years, I saw how formidable that will could be, what it could make happen. And all the labor she put into it, all the physical exercise, all the deliberate blindness, the innocence cultivated, the spiritual epiphanies she was able somehow to experience spontaneously, the very many ways she fell in and out of love like a teenager. All of this came to seem to me effectively a form of energy in itself, a force capable of creating a dilation in time, as if she really were moving at the speed of light away from the rest of us, stranded on Earth and aging faster than her, while she looked down on us and wondered why. The effect was most striking when one of her Bendigo siblings visited, or when she was with Judy, whom she'd known since secondary school. What did these late middle-aged people, with their fucked-up families and wrinkles and disappointments and difficult marriages and physical ailments, what did any of this have to do with Amy? How could any of these people have grown up with her, or once slept with the same boys, or been able to run in the same way, at the same speed, down the same street in the same year? It wasn't only that Amy looked very young, although of course she did. It was that an almost unbelievable youthfulness pulsed through her. It went right down to the bone, affecting the way she sat, moved, thought, spoke, everything. Some, like Marco, her bad-tempered Italian chef, were cynical and bitter about it. They claimed it was only money that did it, that it was all a side effect of money and no work, never any real work. But in our travels with Amy, we met plenty of people with a lot of money who did nothing, far less than Amy, who, in her own way, worked hard, and most of them seemed as old as Methuselah. And so it was reasonable to assume, and a lot of people did, that it was her young lovers that kept Amy young. This was, after all, basically her own argument for years, that and the lack of children. But this theory could not survive the year she cancelled the South American and European tours, and the arrival of her son, Jay, and 2 years later, baby Cara, and the quick dispatching of one middle-aged father and boyfriend, and the obtaining and subsequent even swifter dispatching of the second father and husband, who was, true enough, not much more than a boy himself. Surely, people thought, surely this much experience crammed into a few years will leave its mark. But while the rest of the team came out of that whirlwind exhausted, completely wrung out, ready to lie down for a decade, Amy herself proved largely unaffected. She was more or less as she had always been, full of a terrifying amount of energy. After Cara was born, she went straight back into the studio, Back to the gym, back on tour, more nannies were hired, tutors appeared, and she emerged from it all a few months later, seeming like a mature 26-year-old. She was almost 42. I was just about to turn 30. It was one of those facts about me that Amy had decided to obsessively retain, and for 2 weeks beforehand she kept insisting that we'd have a ladies' night, just the two of us. Phones off, total focus, mindfulness, cocktails, none of which I expected or had asked for, but she wouldn't let it go. And then, of course, the day came, and no mention at all was made of my birthday. Instead, we did press for Norway all day, after which she ate with her children, while I sat in my room alone and tried to read. She was still in the dance studio at 10 when I was interrupted by Judy sticking her head with its unchanged feather cut, remnant of her Bendigo youth, round the door to tell me, without looking up from her phone, that I was to remind Amy we were flying to Berlin the next morning. This was in New York. Amy's dance studio was big as a ballroom, a mirrored box with a bar of walnut that stretched all the way round. It had been dug out of the basement of her townhouse. When I walked in, she was sitting in the horizontal splits, completely still, as if dead, her head thrown forward, a long fringe, red at the time, covering her face. Music was playing. I waited to see if she'd turn to me. Instead, she sprang up and began running through a routine, all the time facing her own reflection in the mirrors. It had been some time since I'd seen her dance. I rarely sat in the crowd for the shows anymore. That aspect of her life felt very distant, the artificial performance of someone I had come to know too well at a deeper, granular level. A person for whom I scheduled abortions, hired dog walkers, ordered flowers, wrote Mother's Day cards, applied creams, administered injections, squeezed spots, wiped very occasional breakup tears, and so on. Most days I wouldn't have known I worked for a performer. My work with and for Amy happened in cars, mostly, or on sofas, in airplanes and offices, on many kinds of screens and in thousands of emails. But here she was dancing, to a song I didn't recognize. I hardly ever went to the studio anymore either, but the steps themselves were familiar. They hadn't changed much over the years. The greater part of her routine has always consisted primarily of a form of strident walking, a powerful, pacing step that marks the boundaries of whatever space she's in, like a big cat methodically prowling around her cage. What surprised me now was its undimmed erotic force. Usually, when we compliment a dancer, we say, "She makes it look easy." This is not the case with Amy. Part of her secret, I felt as I watched her, is the way she's able to summon joy out of effort. For no move of hers flowed instinctively or naturally from the next. Each step was clearly visible, choreographed, and yet as she sweated away at their execution, the hard work itself felt erotic. It was like witnessing a woman cross the line at the end of a marathon, or working towards her own orgasm. That same ecstatic revelation of a woman's will. "Let me finish!" she cried out to her reflection. I walked over to the far corner, slid down the glass wall, sat on the floor and reopened my book. I'd decided to establish a new rule for myself. Read for half an hour an evening, no matter what. The book I had chosen was not long, but I hadn't got very far in it. Reading was basically impossible when you worked for Amy. It was seen, by the rest of the team, as deeply impractical, and I think in some sense fundamentally disloyal. Even if we were flying a long stretch, even if we were heading back to Australia, people were either answering Amy-related emails or flicking through a stack of magazines, which could always be disguised as work, for Amy was either in the magazine you had in your hand, or very soon would be. Amy herself read books, sometimes decent books, recommended by me, more often self-help or diet nonsense that Judy or Granger put in front of her. But Amy's reading was something separate. She was Amy, after all, and could do as she pleased. Sometimes she took ideas from the books I gave her, a time period or a character or a political idea, which would then end up in a flattened and vulgar form, in one video or song or another. But this did not change Judy's opinion on reading in general. For her, it was a kind of vice because it took up valuable time we might otherwise spend working for Amy. Still, sometimes it was necessary, even for Judy, to read a book, because it was about to become a movie vehicle for Amy or was otherwise necessary for a project. And in these situations, she would use our long-haul flights to read a third of whatever it was, with her feet up and a lemon-sucking look on her face. She never read more than a third. I get the basic idea. And when she'd finished, she would give one of four possible judgments. Zippy, which was good. Important, which was very good. Controversial, which could be either good or bad, you never knew. Or literary, which was pronounced with a sigh and an eye roll and was very bad. If I tried to make a case for whatever it was, Judy would shrug and say,
"Well, what do I know? I'm just a little bogan girl from Bendigo."
And this, said within Amy's earshot, killed any project dead. Amy never underestimated the importance of the Heartland. Though she'd left Bendigo behind, did not sound like her people anymore, had always sung with a faux American accent, and often spoke of her childhood as a form of living death, she still considered her hometown a potent symbol, almost a form of bellwether. Her theory was that a star has New York and L.A. in their pocket. A star can take Paris and London and Tokyo, but only a superstar takes Cleveland and Hyderabad and Bendigo. A superstar takes everybody everywhere. "What are you reading?" I held up the book. She drew her legs back together from where they had landed back in the splits and scowled at the cover. "Never heard of it." "Cabaret. Is that, basically?" "A book of the movie?" "The book that came before the movie. I thought it might be useful since we're heading to Berlin. Judy sent me in here to crack the whip." Amy made a face at herself in the mirror. "Judy can kiss my bogan arse. She's been giving me such a hard time recently. Think maybe she's menopausal? Think maybe you're just annoying? Ha ha." She lay down and lifted her right leg up in front of her, waiting. I went over and knelt before her, bending her knee into her chest. I was so much more heavily constructed, broader, taller, weightier, that whenever I stretched her like this, I felt I had to be careful, that she was fragile and I could break her. Though she had muscles I could not imagine having, and I had seen her lift young male dancers almost as high as her head. "The Norwegians were dull, weren't they?" she muttered. And then an idea came to her, as if none of our conversations of the past 3 weeks had happened at all. "Why don't we go out? Like right now. Judy won't know. We'll go out the back way, have a few cocktails. I'm in the mood. We don't need a reason." I smiled at her. I thought about what it must be like to live in this world of shifting facts that move or disappear, depending on your mood. "Something funny?" "Nope. Let's go." She took a shower and got dressed in her civilian outfit. Black jeans, black vest, and a black baseball cap pulled low, which made her ears stick out through her hair and gave her an unexpectedly goofy look. People don't believe me when I say she liked to go out dancing, and it's true, we didn't do it often, not in the later years, but it did happen, and it never created much fuss, probably because we went late and to gay places, and by the time the boys spotted her, they were usually high and happy and full of an expansive sort of goodwill. They wanted to be protective of her. She'd been theirs years ago, before she was anybody's, and looking after her now was a way of demonstrating that she still really belonged to them. Nobody asked for autographs or made her pose for pictures. No one called the papers. We just danced. My only job was to demonstrate that I couldn't keep up with her, and there was no need to fake this. I really couldn't. At the point where my calves burnt and I was as wet with sweat as if I'd stood under a hose, Amy would still be dancing, and I would have to take my seat and wait for her. I was doing just that in the roped-off area when I felt a great thwack on my shoulder and something wet on my cheek. I looked up. Amy stood over me, grinning and looking down, sweat dripping from her face onto mine. "On your feet, soldier. We're shipping out." It was 1 in the morning. Not so late that I wanted to go home. Instead, as we approached the village, she lowered the partition and told Errol to keep going right past the house, to head for 7th and Grove. And when Errol tried to protest, Amy stuck out her tongue and raised the partition. We pulled up outside a tiny, scuzzy-looking piano bar.
I could already hear a man with a grating Broadway vibrato singing a number from Chorus Line. Errol wound down the window and glared at the open doorway. He didn't want to let her go. He looked at me pleadingly, in solidarity, as two people in the same boat. In Judy's eyes, we would both be held responsible tomorrow morning. But there was nothing I could do with Amy once she'd set her will on something. She opened the door and pulled me out of the car. We were both drunk. Amy, overexcited, dangerously re-energized, me, exhausted, maudlin. We sat in a dark corner. The whole place was dark corners. With two vodka martinis, brought over by a barman of Amy's age, so overwhelmed to be serving her, it wasn't clear how he was going to get through the practical matter of putting the drinks in front of us before he collapsed. I took the glasses out of his shaking hands and endured Amy telling me the history of Stonewall, on and on, Stonewall this, Stonewall that, as if I'd never been to New York and didn't know a thing about it. At the piano, a group of white women at a bachelorette party sang something from The Lion King. They had horrible, shrill voices and kept forgetting the words. I knew it was childish, but I was in an absolute rage about my birthday. My rage was the only thing keeping me awake. I was feeding off it in that righteous way you can if you never mention out loud the wrong you are being done. I sank my martini and listened without comment as Amy moved on from Stonewall to her own early days as a jobbing dancer in Alphabet City. In the late 70s, when all her friends were these crazy black boys, queers, divas, all dead now. Stories I had heard so many times I could almost repeat them myself, and I was despairing of finding any way of stopping her talking when she announced she was going to the dunny, in an accent she used only when very drunk. I knew her experience of public toilets to be limited, but before I could get to my feet, she was 20 yards ahead of me. As I tried to pass through the drunken bachelorettes, the piano player looked up at me, hopefully, and grabbed my wrist. "Hey, sister, you sing?" At the same moment, Amy skipped down the basement steps and disappeared from view. "How about this right here?" He nodded at his sheet music and passed a weary hand over the ebony sheen of his bald head. "Can't listen to these girls no more. You know it? From Gypsy?" His elegant fingers were to the keyboard, and I was singing the opening bars, the famous preamble in which only the dead stay home, while people like Mama, oh, they're different. They won't just sit and take it. They've got the dreams and the guts. They won't stay and rot. They'll always fight to get up. And out. I rested a hand on the piano, turned in towards it, closed my eyes, and I can remember thinking I was starting small. At least, that's what I consciously intended to do. To start small and keep it small, singing under the note so as not to be noticed, or not noticed too much, out of the old shyness. But also out of deference to Amy, who was not a natural singer, even if this fact was unspeakable between us. Who was in fact no more a natural singer than the bachelorettes sitting in front of me, sucking down Mai Tais on their barstools. But I was a natural, wasn't I? Surely I was, despite everything. And now I found I couldn't stay small. My eyes stayed closed, but my voice lifted and kept lifting. I got louder and louder. I did not feel I had control of it, exactly. It was something I'd released that now rose up and away and escaped my reach. My hands were in the air. I was stamping my heels into the floor. I felt I had everyone in the room. I even had a sentimental vision of myself as one in a long line of gutsy brothers and sisters, music makers, singers, musicians, dancers, for didn't I, too, have the gift so often ascribed to my people? I could turn time into musical phrases, into beats and notes, slowing it down and speeding it up, controlling the time of my life, finally, at last, here on a stage, if nowhere else. I thought of Nina Simone dividing each note from the next so viciously, with such precision, as Bach, her hero, had taught her to do, and I thought of her name for it. Black classical music. She hated the word jazz. Considering it a white word for black people, she rejected it totally. And I thought of her voice, The way she could extend a note beyond the point of tolerability and force her audience to concede to it, to her timescale, to her vision of the song. How she was completely without pity for her audience, and so relentless in the pursuit of her freedom. But too involved in these thoughts of Nina, I didn't see the end coming. I thought I had another verse. I sang over the concluding chord when it came, and continued some way ahead before I realized, oh, yes, yes.